Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls weekly 2-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We are seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 49, section 5, item 13. That's numbered list item number 2. It's our arc, our local system of inhabited worlds. Oh, day and night, but this is wondrous strange. And therefore, as a stranger, give it welcome, Horatio. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. I'm Brad Garner, and I'm so glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. That's a little bit of Shakespeare, maybe presaging what we'll be reading a little bit about tonight, some things that are not normally in our philosophy. With us tonight is Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, Justin Armstrong, and you. Won't you join us in our study by calling up the text as you see fit and taking your virtual seat for 1% of your week here on Symmetry of Soul? Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. And hello to you, Justin and Andrea, everyone who's joining us as we jump back into all these complexities that Brad was alluding to there with his Shakespeare. Many, many curiosities to contemplate, sometimes becoming sort of incomprehensibly complex. We'll get to that. We'll build up to that. So hopefully everyone can keep on the train here for the ride, and we'll see if we can flesh out as many new insights into, as we've talked about, might be quite oft read material by many longtime readers. But there's always more depth if one can find, the deeper insight to search it out. So enjoy, everyone.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, as I'm sitting here looking at the summary I'm about to read, I'm wondering, how did we get off on the topic that we spent so much time on last week? And there's always a thread that led us there, but it doesn't have anything to do with the number of brains what we have. It's something else that got us there. And good evening, Andrea. How's everything out your way?
Oh, everything out here is just great. I'm extremely blessed to be here this evening with this crew studying this wonderful revelation, and thank my lucky stars every day.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I can't believe that we get an opportunity to study in the way that we do here. We are blessed, privileged, I don't know, this is the way that we're trying to approach it, and we're glad that everyone who's listening now or in the future appreciates or is willing to lend an ear to this approach to studying this marvelous text. And Justin, good evening to you. How fare you, sir?
I'm well. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Andrea, and good evening, Dr. Chris. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to tonight's study.
All right. Well, before we get to this evening's new study proceedings, I will review us, try to, on where we were last week. I will start out, Andrea, by citing something, actually lifting something that you wrote from your previous summary. So this is just turtles all the way down now. I don't know how deep this recursion goes, but it was very noteworthy. Andrea wrote the following evocative assertion in the preceding episode: our Urantia self mirrors the part of us that engages in reflective thinking. That is what will survive this life in the flesh. The rest will be as chaff being blown from the wheat. We must trust the wise and gracious hands who take it all, sift it, keep what is worth keeping, and blow the rest away. So we discussed this. All chaff needs to be blown away, yes. But what chaff are we talking about? Well, there's two possibilities. Number one, there's chaff in the outer life. So my outer life, during my time on this world in the flesh, that's all chaff. My body, my brain, my DNA, none of that survives mortal death. It gets sifted and blown away like chaff in the wind, per God's natural laws. No divine judgment needed, just the technique of mortal death at work. But number two, there's inner life chaff. Do I have chaff in my inner life? Is my inner temple holy and pure, or have I allowed it to become polluted through my own free will choice of personally identifying with unholy ideas and ideals? It's dangerous to self-proclaim one's inner temple is clean. In the story of the Pharisee and the publican in paper 167, the Pharisee self-declared his inner temple was pure, while the publican asked for mercy, humbly. So let's say that you have chaff in your inner life. Whose responsibility is it to clean it up? Well, that led to a long talk about fables. Will God clean up my inner life for me? Well, this is certainly a story I've heard all my life from various sources. Maybe you have too. Here's a story like this. A man once prayed, God, come into my inner life and sift the good and bad for me. In Jesus' name, I command you, God, to make in me a clean heart. And yea, that man's inner temple was cleansed, and all the while did that man consume many Cheetos and sit idly as God worked this in him. Does that sound like the God that we know from the fifth epical revelation? Does this story bear up under the scrutiny of the light of an epical revelation? Well, no. It's a pleasing fable, combined with some supreme magic of uttering Jesus' name. And the fifth epical revelation calls on me, calls on us to disabuse myself of pleasing fables, no matter how sentimental or cherished they are, or how darned inconvenient it may be to me and my ease-seeking self that I've got some hard cleaning up to do. You see, I am absolutely sovereign in my inner life. Any chaff that's in there was dragged in there by me through my own evil or sinful choices. God does not get in there and clean it up for me. It's that one little measure of my energy in the cosmos that I'm sovereign over. I am, as the revelators write, quote, most truly the architect of my own eternal destiny in that respect with free will. Now, so what's a guy and his chaff-polluted inner life to do? Pray robustly, sincerely, intelligently according to light, as Jesus put it. This sincere prayer will psychologically reform my mind. It alters my perspective. It improves my management of my mind, cultivates discrimination, promotes better access to Holy Spirit ministries. It lets me see the chaff that must be let go of in my inner life. And you can see the difference if you take this responsibility on and you take delight in cultivating, as we're so fond of saying. And we here at Symmetry of Soul, we know it can be scary to let go of what you've held on to for a lifetime. But fear not. God assures us we'll be supported in righteousness through the considerable commotion of such inner temple cleansing. Phew. So with that fable out of the way, let's examine another cherished story. A man once willfully engaged in sinful thoughts and behavior, and then 3 days later, with no shred of repentance, he was hit by a bus and he died. Ah, but not to worry. He woke up on the first mansion world with those latter-day sins of his forgotten, because his all-good thought adjuster discarded those sinful thoughts that he'd willed. In fact, since his Marantia self was only good and positive stuff, he more or less woke up as a divine being and, like everyone else, has very little work to do on the mansion worlds. I mean, they're basically just a holiday, free harps and clouds for everyone. Does that sound right? Is that the cosmos we've been taught in the fifth epical revelation? Of course not. Yet it's popular. It's even an orthodoxy of some among many of the Urantia Book readers these days. But it's just a warmed-over version of that ancient fable where the magic of death instantly transforms us into perfect beings. Or we might say it's warmed-over Christian universalism. No, in light of the fifth epical revelation, this story makes no sense. Actually, it's quite akin to the Lucifer Manifesto, someone saying, I can do whatever I want in this life, and there are no eternal consequences because God loves me, and I'll just be perfect no matter what I do. Is that man being the architect of his own destiny? But, you protest, how could God do that to me? Why would God let me wake up in the afterlife with defects or even a sinful character? Well, to some extent, you're correct. A thought adjuster's existentially perfect core would not allow this. But remember, the adjuster also gains experience. Remember, they start their training on Divinington? And that experiential aspect of a thought adjuster is always subservient to our will. Yes, there are abundant mercy credits in the universe, thank God. But mercy, they tell us, quote, is not to be thrust upon those who despise it. For those of us committed to living in the light of an epical revelation, we've been shown this greater light. Would you now presume to reject it? Would you presume on divine mercy because you'd prefer to live your own way? Would you rather be antagonistic toward God? Well, be careful, because if you know better, you no longer have any excuse for your attitude, as Jesus said, and the light that would save you, as Jesus said, can only condemn you if it is knowingly rejected. There's a bit of a tempering consolation here, though. Choice and willpower must be in play for the adjuster to do this soul building. If you're just floating along with the evil drift of the world, wholly ignorant of the light of heaven, your free will's not in play. But it's not best to assume you're just some social automaton. No, it's better to assume you actually have willpower in this life and are responsible for your actions. And therefore, you can someday be prepared for a just and merciful reckoning. Okay, then one other topic we covered about the planetary conduct of our neighbors. I had to throw this in, even though this is a long review. This strange planetary conduct, this must not be the conduct of individuals on other worlds or even nations on that world, that nearby world. It must be something concerning the world as a whole. And we took on some carefully controlled speculation with this word planetary as our license. We can't directly support or refute the following, but we considered these ideas of planetary conduct. Number one, maybe our nearby neighbors, the non-breathers, have made their planet not visible to our telescopes. Number two, the relationship of their planet to our planet in some sanctioned planetary scale initiative. Number three, other planetary scale conduct issues disclosed to us by comparison, including lesser angels, for example. Planetary conduct number four, maybe they will clean up our space probes and space junk once we lose contact and they become garbage floating in interstellar space. After all, in light and life, every automaton is precisely managed in the universe. And then number five, we reminded ourselves that this is not Star Trek. Even though there are beings on other planets, arbitrary interplanetary conquest and behavior is not allowed. Humans are not sovereign over interplanetary space. Okay, then we did get to the reading. Paper 49, Section 4, Evolutionary Will Creatures. We are up from the humus. In fact, we literally till the soil we are up from, like all breathing humans do on all worlds. Yes, we're also subject to microbial diseases, more so here than on average worlds. And humans, up from the humus, we stand erect and upright. Even that basic physiological fact of standing upright invites reflection on what it means to be a human who stands up straight. Even the word upright reminds us of the taking hold of the divine law and being righteous. Don't be up wrong. There's a lot of over-control of evolution. Listen to the archive for more, including how our experimental world may have more of this over-control kind of shown to us than the average world. The key takeaway is we should not over-identify with our biological race or even our maleness or our femaleness. Nothing of this world should we over-identify with. And we certainly should not apply spiritual energy to our mere physical identities. That just makes it that much harder for us to ascend if we've got big feet of clay on us. Our authors call on us to think about our material existence more objectively. They state we have 12 senses, but folk wisdom says there's only 5 senses. Huh, is your Urantia book hopelessly in error here, 12 senses? Well, here's a simple case where you can catch yourself being all too eager to dismiss the fifth epical revelation as being an error. Instead, sit with the tension and reflect. Remember, ancient people and their folk wisdom barely separated the mind from the body at all. Just think about, do you have a sense of balance? Now, that's one. A sense of your own body position? That's another. A sense of pain? That's another. So, 12 senses. Another objective matter. Physical conditions of human bodies on inhabited worlds may vary tremendously, but our mental life is all very similar. This pattern of transcendence, the mind over matter, reminds us that spirit, likewise, is transcendent of both mind and matter, and personality is transcendent of all mere physical things and mindal things and even spirit things. It's a unifier of them. Personality itself isn't even male or female. Okay, then finally, we started reading Section 5, The Planetary Series of Mortals. We're going to continue that tonight. Planetary physical types are a rather matter-of-fact observation. That's something we read previously about, planetary physical types. But these planetary series, not types, but series, they're a bigger picture, not just about local adaptation to conditions on a world for physical reasons. A planetary series is about how humans across worlds are related to one another. These planetary series are transcendent of mere local conditions on a world. A serial is not the same as a series, and there's precision of language there again in the book, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that tonight. But for now, that ends the summary, and I welcome any thoughts or comments.
Great job, Brad.
Yeah, wonderful job.
More, Brad, more. Another 15 minutes. Everyone is having great fun. Yes, and I'm sure you could have gone on a lot longer. We often cover a lot of material, especially when we get off on those very complex attempts to flesh out a topic that may, as you were saying, may not be immediately, apparently, relevant. I often try to help people see how, if there's truth being discussed, that truth applies universally. And, it's often the case that we can take those extended initial discussions and use them as a framing mechanism for examining some aspects of the material that we then subsequently read in a way that might not have occurred to you if just pulling out the book and starting to read that section. Mm-hmm. So, truth is a surround fact. It isn't linear, and so there's an infinite number of truth vantage points that one can use on any passage in the Revelation.
Very true. Yeah.
That makes sense. I wanted to add that just real quick, Brad, for those of you who enjoyed the summaries, you can go back and read them again on the Symmetry of Soul website, symmetryofsoul.org. And over on the left-hand side, you'll see the archive of the episodes. And then just click on the episode you're interested in. And you'll see Brad's notes and the summaries that have been done and a lot of other detail that's quite interesting.
Yeah, thanks for that plug for our website, Andrea. Yeah, we've had that some form of the website up since the very beginning, but some years ago it took on a more expansive thing with the summaries and all. But the comment I wanted to make, just reflecting on the writing of the summary, that's just beyond meta. I don't even know what that is. It's just, the topic that we talked about, this survival and what constitutes the soul and how do our choices and decisions affect that which survives this life. It's a controversial topic. Like on the face of it, it doesn't seem to be, because people often just see a sort of universalist doctrine. Everyone gets to heaven and all's harps and clouds. But this really needs to be dug into. There's a whole new theology here. It's sort of Christian. It's revelatory. It's not entirely like anything that's come before. Intuitively, we all must know that the choices we make in this life must have eternal consequences. Otherwise, what's the point of this life? But it's just very controversial to suggest that some God-type aspect might actually be very willingly going along with you as you destroy yourself and saying, okay, well, you can do that, you can do that. Of course, that's free will at its heart, but to really think that through and what the implications are is not easy, apparently. And so I just tried to find a different voice to say the same thing that we said last week. I'm not harping on this. I'm just saying, I'm just trying to find a way to say these things multiple different ways, because it's not easy to get this, apparently.
Yeah, and just I was thinking as you were trying to give some summary life to our conversation there, and you were kind of asking the rhetorical question of, why does God allow that to happen? you know, that you can destroy yourself, you know, or that, you know, your temple floor can go unswept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's because he loves you that much. He loves you so much that he gave you absolute free will over that domain.
Yeah.
You know, and it's you know, you have to think about the full consequences of saying that God loves you absolutely and infinitely. You know, it's you know, we always tend to just limit our thoughts about his love to you know, I mean, what immediately is you know, the answers to our desires. You know, I desire such and so. Well, fortunately, God loves me, and so, you know, I'll get my desire fulfilled. But, you know, he loves you absolutely, not relatively like that.
Yeah.
And so when you take off all the relativities, there you have it. He loves you so much that he gave you free rein. You know, he didn't say, "Well, I love you, but I'm not going to let you, you know, do that." No, he loves you. And so because of that absolute infinite love, it all boils down to our free will in our inner life. Like you said, we're certainly not sovereign over interstellar space. We're not even sovereign over our bodies.
Yeah.
Okay. But we are, you know, and because we're not sovereign over our bodies, you know, there's no way for us to be sovereign over the lower domain of our mind in the hourglass analogy of our mindal self. But we are sovereign over the upper domain in that analogy, the domain of your personalized self, of spiritualized mind. It's that personality that gives you that sovereignty. And that's the only energy in the entire, you know, forget about, you know, grand universe, master universe, just think eternally, the cosmos infinite. The only energy in the entire infinite cosmos that you have sovereignty over is that mind energy in that upper domain. But he loves you so much, he gave you unconditional sovereignty there.
And it's so fascinating that, you know, the inner life, you know, which is referenced a handful of times in the Urantia book, notably one section that's titled that. We've talked about this on and off over the years. It's a largely unexplored domain. I mean, Viktor Frankl alluded to it in his book. Andy Dufresne refers to it in The Shawshank Redemption. But I think a lot of people think the inner life is maybe my imagination, where my imaginary friends are, but it's something else. It's just a spacious place that is not at all the outer life. So it's kind of this not entirely unpioneered, unexplored territory, but it's not necessarily easy to find because it's nothing like the outer life, anything part of your sense perceptions at all.
Yeah, and you know, the fifth epical revelation is trying to take us beyond merely the contemplation of the quote-unquote inner life. I mean, the inner life, precisely, that term refers to the interplay between the upper domain, you know, the hourglass analogy, and the cosmos. Your life, that inner life, is that interplay. It's not, you know, the stuff, the nature of the domain and, you know, the upper domain itself. The fifth epical revelation is, you know, is sort of introducing us to, you know, it's like, well, if there's an interplay, it has to be between two domains. If one domain is the cosmos, what's the other domain? You know, and the fifth biblical revelation is you know, it's introducing us to that other endpoint of that interplay. Begin to think about the nature, the physics of what you are. You know, the part of you that was created. You know, in contrast to the part that was born. You know, we've done a lot of scientific analysis of the body that was born, and you know, you can begin to contemplate, and humans have kind of, sort of, about the mind that's attuned to that which is born, you know, and begin to think about the nature of that, that aspect of your mind, mind that is attuned to the birth you, right, the conceived and born you. But what about the part of you that wasn't born? Now, that isn't foundationally attuned to your body at all.
They give a really good expression of this when they say the number assigned to a telephone subscriber does not in any manner identify the personality of that subscriber or signify anything concerning his character.
Well, yeah, and that just brings in, you know, not only do you have the literalness of that domain that's established by the creative mother spirit, you know, a creator being, but then there's that deity influence that was individuated and bestowed by God the Father upon that created part of you, your personality.
Yeah.
I mean, see, obviously, you know, if you haven't begun to examine the nature of that upper domain itself, even recognize its existence in any sort of direct logical way, how could you have even started to think about the influences that impinge only upon that domain? Like, first, your personality, right? And then, you know, the spirit of truth, the thought adjuster, we'll be, you know, studying some of the aspects of our design that has to do with those issues, you know, the nature of that upper domain, the nature of the interface between that domain and the cosmos. These issues are literal. There are life carrier equations, concerning these issues and when they're designing us. So, that's sort of getting into, as I try to, not just say nature, but use that word that means nature, physics, as a way of getting people to not just blow past the word nature in some sort of mystical way, right? But to think of it, more literally. Right? I mean, the paper in the book, the second paper that's entitled "The Nature of God," you could, call that the physics of God. The word physics means nature. Okay? The revelator, that is a very key part of the fifth epical revelation, that everything has a literal physics. Nothing is mystical. Nothing is magical. Nothing is imaginary. Even your imagination has a physics. Even your evil has a physics. Even your sin has a physics. Iniquity has a physics. God has a physics. Angels have a physics.
Says the physicist, but
prayer
it's the right
has
thing
a physics.
Say. Right.
Right. You know, it's not just a psychologic procedure, which technically is a mindful physics, okay? But there's an actual spirit substance physics associated with it. And spirit is a substance. Whoa. Yeah. Talk about bringing in physics. So that's, we're face to face with this as we're about to start our reading. This isn't a sci-fi writer imagining fanciful beings. Right? This is the physics of creatures in a holistic physics that is a cosmos.
Indeed.
So, it's a very unfamiliar intellectual effort. Humans have never challenged themselves to think like this, like the revelation expects you to begin to think, to dispel all just, well, I don't know, it's a whatever, magic fills in the gaps. It's like to just refuse such a thought. And find a fact-based reality and a truth that can be related to that fact. Truth can't relate to figment. If you don't find fact, you'll never know truth.
And in the same way that you can relate the upper hemisphere of truth to sort of this physics or this nature of fact, you could take that word character and create an upper hemisphere in relationship to the nature of the physics of these energy systems, and you could see that the character is just as essential in understanding the wholeness of the process, not just merely the nature or the physics.
Right. I mean, there's elements of character, are literally, mindal forms, literal mindal forms, there's a specific physics to all of that. I mean, when you're ascending, you'll learn all this, right? It all has, like I was saying, it all has equations and, is analyzable and, mathematically describable. You have 2.3 units of this type of character. I mean, everything is literal. And, I know I've brought this up before, but it's sort of just staring us in the face as we're going to start to read here in a minute. Why all this stuff? And I'm just interested, in fostering my inclination to be a kindly mystic. And so I found this book in the bookstore. It's like, well, this wasn't the book you were looking for.
No. It has some passages, excerpts that taken out of context can satisfy you momentarily. They can feed you like sugar water, but they won't nourish you because that's not the whole of the book. Not at all. The book is not that at all.
And just to play on another element that you were bringing out in the review there, I mean, not only does God not get in there and sweep the temple floor any more than he swept the temple floor in Jerusalem. No, humans had to sweep the temple floor in Jerusalem, even the Holy of Holies floor. There are lots of dust storms in that neck of the woods, so yeah, they had to sweep the floor. Not only does he not do that, but we're going to read about life carriers designing mortals in some ways that are startling, that have, at least short-term impact on your whole potential to have a relationship with God.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't be surprised if, that naive, that simple question comes up again in your mind tonight. Why would God do that? Why would God create a one-brained being? They seem just hopelessly, they seem lobotomized, and so, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. So, right. Lots of sort of, fanciful notions of, of false equality are just that, false notions.
Yeah. All right.
You know, and the real God, you know, that you're encouraged to discover the factual nature of, you know, is the God of this universe, not the one of our dreams, not the one of our false idealistic desires.
All right.
But
well,
that God loves you, right? Like I was saying, Jesus tried to, introduce us to this, so that we'd have something to hold on to. It's like, yeah, okay, all these things about brain types are okay, but remember, God loves you, so don't think that somehow because there's differences of brain types in mortals that that somehow means God's love is relative.
No.
I mean, if anything, see, the more that you can, you can read things that kind of challenge your preconceived, notions about God, the more you might actually find the actual fifth epical revelation of God the Father. Right? Instead of still trying to be a student of the Urantia book with a pre-third epical revelation of God the Father.
Mm.
Yeah, at best, if you haven't even, corrupted it to something that sort of is, pre-primitive. You can't use a third epical revelation, even, or a fourth epical revelation of God the Father to understand the fifth epical revelation of God the Father. That should be numerically obvious. It's not, it doesn't say, ditto's on the third and the fourth. Yeah, I mean, it validates the truth of what was said there, but takes things up a notch. The cosmology, Jesus had to conform to in the people he was talking to 2,000 years ago, okay, the fifth epical revelations aren't limited to that small cosmology. And that means that the nature of God the Father is apparently changed. Okay, it's not really. Right?
Not really.
But it appears to, right? I always thought God was like such and so. It's like, well, he never was, but, he could appear to be limited in a smaller revelatory cosmology, right? He can appear to kind of just be, sort of system sovereign like sort of guy if you're in the fourth epical, or in the first epical revelation, right? Because that's the way he's presented, as if he was a system sovereign, and in the second epical revelations as if he was the Constellation Father, et cetera.
Yeah.
But really, he's absolutely transcendent of such temporal, spatial, downstepped facts.
He's a universal Father. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Anyway, you get the point. So kind of trying to motivate a little bit up front here. How you can go beyond just the immediacies of, putting on a scientific hat when you start reading about brain types.
I appreciate the framing, Chris. Let's get into it and see what we can figure out in a philosophic frame of mind and in a living frame of mind. We're in paper 49 of the Urantia Papers, The Inhabited Worlds, section 5, the planetary series of mortals, starting at the top of page 566 in the original publication. And this is numbered item 2, brain type series. The one physical uniformity of mortals is the brain and nervous system. Nevertheless, there are three basic organizations of the brain mechanism, the one, the two, and the three brain types. Urantians are of the two-brain type, somewhat more imaginative, adventurous, and philosophical than the one-brained mortals, but somewhat less spiritual, ethical, and worshipful than the three-brained orders. These brain differences characterize even the pre-human animal existences.
Yeah, which is why you can see they're validly called pre-human and not merely factually subhuman, right? Because they're foreshadowing the human design, even though factually they are yet, subhuman, they are pre-human. Right? In truth, they are pre-human.
Mm-hmm.
Right from the get-go. Even the single-celled plants on this world are pre-humans of this particular will creature design. Right? Mm. It all starts with single-celled plants, remember, to produce a particular designed will creature. Amazing ability to understand all of the vicissitudes of mind relating to matter and the evolution, physical evolution of the world and all that stuff.
Right.
Over hundreds of millions of years. All right, but we were pushing this conversation forward from last week when we were talking about the Sangiks, the Sangik races, whether there was six or three, and that comment about how you've got three-brainers when you're talking about worlds that just have the three primaries, right? And they said most inhabited worlds have all of these races, but many of the three-brained planets harbor only the three primary types. Okay, now notice it's not all of the, but you have a rough parallel there, and then some local systems have only the three primary Sangiks, like they say there back in second paragraph of section four. So we were talking about it. Justin, you may recall I was kind of saying, we'll get to the talking about the brain types, and here we are.
Yes.
Where you can see, very immediately in what they just said in that paragraph of, the vertical relationship that one wants to very much visualize when you're talking about, one, two, three brain, three over two over one. In terms of what kind of mind activity is sort of basal, with such brain differences. How do you take it up a notch from the one brain to the two brain, and you get mind activity that's somewhat more imaginative, adventurous, and philosophical. And you take it up another notch, and you get it, somewhat more spiritual and ethical and worshipful.
It's yeah. Almost like a little microcosm of the triune nature, where you're having that philosophical domain is sort of like the second cosmic intuition territory, and the worshipful domain is sort of that third cosmic intuition territory. The brain mechanisms themselves are sort of representing that threefold nature.
Well, and again, remember, it's the source of this mind activity is not the brain. Right?
Sure.
It's just that all of this mind activity is possible within the adjutant mind system. It's just that when that adjutant mind is attuned to a particular biologic system, that attunement frames. Establishes boundary conditions for that mind, like we've talked about many times, and the adjutant mind is hence limited within that framing.
Yes. Yes.
Now notice that I said that the basal mind activity, right, because all of us can take delight in cultivating. And use the adjutant mind less and less within that perforce inescapable biologic framing down at the lower levels. You know, I don't have to be, you know, my basal nature, which is less worshipful, less, you know, thinking the truth than the three-brainers. But I start out that way.
Yes.
They start out, you know, not having a mind that's, you know, that's so, you know, foundationally lowered is mine. But I, you know, I have the free will to move up. And you know, like you were, when you were thinking about the kind of the threefold actuality pattern there, again, it's just simply because this is vertical, you know, and so, you know, in that hourglass analogy, because personality is taking hold of a spirit and wielding it on mind, it gives an effective in a personality context, you know, of spirit over mind over matter. You know, and hence, you know, you have a natural potential for a vertical threefoldness with individuals that are, you know, more basally attuned to the individuality of the material lower interface, ones that are kind of floating more in the middle, you know, with some interplay, between the material and the spiritual, and then ones that are, mm-hmm. you know, being founded closer to the upper boundary with the spiritual.
It reminds me of this. Oh, go ahead, Andrea.
Just a quick question. Were you using that word basally? You said basally attuned. Is that, am I hearing that correct? And
yeah, you know, the base.
Base.
I mean, what is it?
Oh,
what is it foundationally?
Okay. Okay. All right. That's what I needed. Thanks.
Yeah, basal.
It reminds me of
its foundational nature.
Of sort of the similarity that you've touched upon in one of your papers, Perfecting Horizons, and the colored races, where red man is kind of leaning towards that unity side, yellow is leaning towards the associativity side, and blue towards the individuality side. And it's a kind of a fun fact that us being two-brainers here on 606, they use that adventurous word when they're talking about Andon and Fanta. In 62.5, they say they were so curious and adventurous that they nearly lost their lives on numerous occasions before they were 8 years old. I just think it's a fun little fact there that particular word is used to describe those two-brained humans on our world, the first humans on our world.
Yeah, and you know, the fundamental you know, drive there is because when you bring in you know, especially the seventh adjutant, you know, you bring in the sixth and the seventh adjutants, you know, above the animal, five adjutant animal mind of Andon and Fanta's parents, and you know, you bring in something that is very definitively now not so place-like, you know, like even technically all of the first six adjutants. Right, that seventh adjutant very much introduces a directionization into the mind activity that is fundamentally not there without it. You know, no matter how much you know, an animal might seem to be very directional, you know, it's just, you know, their instincts playing out spatially. You know, they're being you know, drawn, you know, through space, as opposed to driving themselves through space, as it were. Humans can drive themselves through space, right? They can take the wheel, right? They're just being dragged along by instinct. And point, you know, I think I need to migrate from here to there, right? You know, you're literally just being dragged as an animal from point A to point B, right? You know, it's not some self-initiative. Right, but a human can be adventurous, right? Because they're directionized. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's there in all humans, one brain, two brain, three brain. Right? But again, you just, if you liberate that directional sense, you know, a little bit more from its, you know, being ensconced, you know, being encased in, you know, in all of the place likeness of the other adjutants. you get something that's more adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the one-brainers aren't adventurous, right? Yeah. Those first, you know, the Anda and Vanta, quote-unquote, on a one-brain world, right? The first two humans on a one-brain world are adventurous relative to their parents, very much so. Okay. Let's see, to think about how that is just ever more liberated. You know, and once you liberate that more, it needs to be controlled more. You know, everyone knows there's foolish adventurers.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And also, on the flip side...
And the three-brainers, are less foolish adventurers by nature.
Right.
One example of sort of the other direction in terms of imaginative, there's the quote, the reference... from 58.2, and yet some of the less imaginative of your mortal mechanists insist on viewing material creation and human evolution as an accident. So it kind of shows you when you go in that opposite direction and you're not imaginative, you're moving into this sort of static domain where you're lacking a philosophical wholeness of what's really going on in the process of evolution.
All these things are, you liberate them, but the more you liberate them, the more they need to be self-controlled.
Yes.
If you aren't a three-brainer, the self-control isn't going to be so naturally there. You're going to have to assume that. There's lots of foolish imagining, lots of foolish adventuring, right? Lots of, false, foolish philosophy.
Certainly.
Right. Yeah. So, but anyway, the point was we got off on quite a bit of a tangent there. But the point is, see the innate verticalness, that they're presenting there, and face that. God is, you could say at least allowing life carriers, right, that He's delegated this duty to make humans, hierarchically related one to another. Talk about a challenge to, some false material idealism about mortal creatures. God would never make someone, vertically, inferior relative to other mortals. Yes, He would.
Yeah. In a brain or physical sense, but not in a spiritual sense, not in a... Yeah.
Not in a potential height sense. Right? I mean, the right. Ceilings, if you want, are all the same.
Right.
Right? I mean, because the ceiling is, up at the level of absoluteness. That personality came down from the level of absoluteness. Right? Okay. So everyone's, ceilings go all the way up there. But, where do you start?
And this pattern's everywhere. You have this in primary and secondary midway. You have it everywhere. This pattern of,
right.
Yeah.
Sang. We just faced the fact that there are, secondary sanghics, right? And that isn't just a technical thing. That's that you're talking superior and inferior in some sense. Yeah. Above and below.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's obvious, that, if the primaries are above and the three brains are above, gee, is it surprising that there's a parallel between the two?
From the two-hemisphere type of the Urantian cerebral cortex, you can, by analogy, grasp something of the one-brained type. The third brain of the three-brained orders is best conceived as an evolvement of your lower or rudimentary form of brain, which is developed to the point where it functions chiefly in control of physical activities, leaving the two superior brains free for higher engagements, one for intellectual functions and the other for the spiritual counterparting activities of the thought adjuster.
Okay, so here's where, we need to make sure we challenge the pop psychology that we've probably all been raised in.
Mm-hmm.
When it becomes obvious, and you're reading this for the first time, oh, my two brains, they mean the two hemispheres. Oh, Oh, yeah, I know all about that. One is all about, quote, unquote, the logical. The other is all about the creative, or some sort of pop psychology notion like that.
Sure.
Again, just like the thing with the senses. What do you mean there's 12 senses or something, on that order? There's just five. It's like, well, no, actually, if you take it out of, the historical common notions, and you confront current science, like I was saying last week, the problem is that 12, the problem isn't that 12 is too big a number, the problem is that 12 is too small a number, right? If you actually go with current science, as they're trying to, figure out how many senses there are. It's like, wow, there's a whole bunch of them. It's like, no, there isn't actually that many, really. It's like, well, how do you know? Well, because the Revelators tell you should get something around on the order of 12. The Revelators? just like they try to help you with how many phyla are there actually? The more current reductionist scientists stare at this stuff, the more are these categories they find. They'll have 500 senses pretty soon.
Sure.
Okay? Instead of five. Okay. And it will be absurd. You can reject this book because it says there's only 12. This whole bit of not superimposing, like pop psychology on a paragraph like we just read. Okay. I mean, actual science is. There isn't as much contrast between the two hemispheres, as one is led to, believe, in popular rationalization schemes.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more equal. Okay, but what the fifth epical revelation is pointing out here is, but you're picking up on something that if you pull down all of the stuff that's in your upper hemispheres right now, and really put that all in a lower brain that's much more developed than the one you have, then you will see, cleared of the fog, right, a more definitive distinction between the two hemispheres. The three-brainers, right, it isn't just pop psychology difference. You've unmasked, right, the potential for a true contrast between those two brains, those two hemispheres, which means you've opened up a super additive consequence that a two-brainer doesn't have, right, because they don't have that much contrast between the two hemispheres. So, again, super additive, right? The three-brainers have mental activity that's above two-brainers.
Chris, are they saying that our cerebellum, that back part of our brain that mainly does physical activity?
Well, there's much more than just the cerebellum. The cerebellum is kind of a focusing mechanism, in play. But the whole lower brain, there's all kinds of structures, the midbrain and all these structures, all the way down to the medulla oblongata and the spinal column. Right? I mean, all of that, is developed, right, into, a more significant brain.
Okay.
Okay. Exactly what the morphology is, I couldn't tell you, of course, right? But, like they said, you can't even, you can kind of imagine the morphology of a one-brainer, but, you're going to be off the mark if you try to imagine the three-brainer morphology based upon your two-brainer morphology.
Just a super quick question. Have you wondered whether the non-breathers, the world that's close to us, do you think that they are three-brainers, or have you thought about that?
Or one-brainers? Or again, they could be anything. Like, they're going to find out here shortly.
Okay.
They could be any of the three. Anyway, the point is, if you actually, look at the two hemispheres in a three-brainer, at these two upper hemispheres, that they have analogous to ours, you know, you have a much more definitive, where you have a mind that has separate seating, and you know, very kind of definitively, differentiated, where the individuality-based mind activity is seated, you know, on one hemisphere, and the unity-based mind activity is seated on the other hemisphere. Right? I mean, that, the mind is still an associative phenomenon, right? But it divides into a more definitive, you know, bifurcated phases of the mind activity that's fundamentally unity-based in contrast to individuality-based.
Hmm.
And it's that unity-based phase of the mind, right? The thought adjuster, as a effectively a spirit fragment influence, right? You know, can relate to. I mean, that's another reason why the adjuster, you know, has limited ability to influence us two-brainers, because the part that it needs to engage is all muddled up with the part that, you know, it doesn't relate to. You know, but if it engages what it can, the part that it, you know, it doesn't have an interface with, a more individuality-based part of the mind, has a much greater tendency to muddle up what it does, like the revelators point out. But the three-brainers don't have that problem. The adjuster has a much clearer path to influencing their minds. See, so again, God shortchanged us. Why would God do this to us?
How dare he, right. Yeah. How could he do this to us? Yeah, there you go.
Right.
Because it all plays out in supremacy. There's some reason for it, and we just have to trust him.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is the hand we were dealt to see if you can ascend to God with this starting point. You know, and not only are we going to make you a two-brainer, but coincidentally, there's going to be a rebellion and a default. Good luck. Right. And so again, to see, you know, it just challenges some sort of self-serving, simplistic notion of, you know, who God is and, you know, how he relates to you. God is not down here in the details. I mean, God didn't shortchange you.
All right.
He gave everyone the exact same personality. That's all he gave you. He didn't give you your brain type.
Yeah, and you have what you need to ascend. I mean, you're not hopelessly hamstrung. You're given your path and your path through it all.
You have to face what hand you were dealt to start with. But again, like I said, the destiny is identical for all, because the personality is identical for all. But the, you know, the starting point, the origin and the history, you know, is very different.
Mm-hmm.
The destiny
sure
is the same.
I'm imagining the master sons getting together and having conversations. Well, what kind of brain type did you have on your seventh bestowal when you were incarnate in human? Just having a casual conversation, comparing the contrasting the differences.
Oh, you lucky dog. You got a three-brainer incarnation. I had to do a two-brainer on your rancho.
Yeah. And I had to face a system sovereign rebelling against me with just two brains.
One brain tied behind my back, yes.
All right. While the terrestrial attainments of the one-brained races are slightly limited in comparison with the two-brained orders, the older planets of the three-brained group exhibit civilizations that would astound your Ranchans, and which would somewhat shame yours by comparison. In mechanical development and material civilization, even in intellectual progress, the two-brained mortal worlds are able to equal the three-brained spheres, but in the higher control of mind and development of intellectual and spiritual reciprocation, you are somewhat inferior.
So again, just in case you hadn't gotten the vertical, you know, let's literally say it, you know, either the word superior or the word inferior, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gotta face that. Spiritual reciprocation, you know, so, again, I mean, if nothing else, this might foster that favorable condition called humble. And disabuse you of, you know, fantasies about, you know, all kinds of fancy doings with your thought adjuster. The interesting thing there is kind of in the middle of that paragraph, and which would somewhat shame yours by comparison. Anyone kind of is like, shame, that's an interesting way to say
it.
It
is.
Yeah.
It's like shame. Let's see. So what, you know, in other words, you know, it's like, man, our civilization is a disgrace. Oh, yeah. My tendency would be to think of it as a disgrace. You know, dis means apart. Apart from grace. I look at this three-brainer. It's like, wow, why does God pour out more grace on the three-brainer world than on mine? I'm apart from his grace.
Right.
Shame yours in comparison. So, yeah, see, they're literally kind of putting in there to, you know, what we've been playing with already. You know, why did God shortchange me here? So the challenge is, you know, is before you there. Can you take your God concept up to the fifth epical level, right, so that you don't think in such anthropomorphic terms about, you know, why is God dissing me here?
All such comparative estimates concerning the intellectual progress or the spiritual attainments of any world or group of worlds should, in fairness, recognize planetary age. Very much depends on age, the help of the biologic uplifters, and the subsequent missions of the various orders of the divine sons.
No, well, that's not helping me. I have a defaulted biologic uplifter, a rebellious planetary present. But you can see. I mean, I already, you know, brought that in. I mean, you know, when you move things forward in time towards light and life, you might picture that as, you know, going horizontally, you know, forward in time, you know, towards light and life. Okay, but remember, the mortals are going vertically. Right? And so the higher the mortal, the less these foundational, basal issues are critical. The feet of clay are still technically there. You know, I mean, no matter how much genetic engineering on this world, will still be two brainers and not three brainers.
Yeah, sure.
There still is that lower foundation of our, you know, of our one master, as it were, right? The two masters that we perforce serve, right? But, you know, you are dwelling consciously, intellectually, higher and higher above that foundation level, you know, as the world advances.
While the three-brained peoples are capable of a slightly higher planetary evolution than either the one- or two-brained orders, all have the same type of life plasm and carry on planetary activities in very similar ways, much as do human beings on Urantia. These three types of mortals are distributed throughout the worlds of the local systems. In the majority of cases, planetary conditions had very little to do with the decisions of the life carriers to project these varied orders of mortals on the different worlds. It's a prerogative of the life carriers thus to plan and execute.
But no explanation. Isn't that annoying.
just a prerogative, yeah.
All right. So, yeah, well, what do? They flip a coin. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is going to be a three-brain world. You know, but see, you know, like I was telling you, Andrea, see, I told you they would make a statement about that. It's just, you can't speculate. There's no basis for it. I mean, it could be anything. You know, you could have five inhabited worlds, you know, in some particular solar system, and you know, have five different variations of this and the next one, the Spirit Reception series.
Yeah.
You know, you got one brain, two brains, three brains, it's, you know, et cetera. I mean, you're left to just wonder. It's like, well, how do they decide? I'm in the mood for a one-brainer again. You guys agree? Yeah, okay, let's go with a one-brainer. I mean, how do they do this?
Yeah. They cast lots.
Maybe it's
for the Supreme to react to. Yeah.
Yeah. How much influence is that parent, that architect of days influence having in their decisions and when they're making these calculations? When the life carriers are trying to get specific on the numbers of one, two, and three brainers.
That ancient of days, you mean? Yes.
Ancient of days. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean. Right, we have what Ancient of Days involved, and yeah, I mean, yeah, again, you can. You know, there's just all kinds of speculation. Is it sort of like I was kind of teasing there? It's like, well, I don't know. I kind of feel like it should be, you know, or is there a very objective science, you know, and then nothing else? I mean, if it does have something to do with, you know, their creation, like you're suggesting there. Right. See, then it's kind of, it's like, well, I don't know. My intuition is, you know, and then you're recognizing that in the grand scheme of things, there's a divinity in all of that. Okay. It isn't just, you know, a whim. But nonetheless, yeah, very, very, you know, it's just an interesting, you know, that from going from all there is in a monotheistic, you know, religion, you know, is there's this one magical guy, you know, that creates everything, right? Every living creature and everything. It's like, no, Universal Father doesn't have anything to do with any of this stuff. It's all in the hands of, you know, beings that, you know, they aren't creators at all, right? Like a creator, son, a creator, mother, spirit. They're just creatures.
They're, yeah. And engineers,
yeah,
of a sort.
Yeah, they're chemists and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be very hard to explain that to someone who hasn't spent years trying to wrap their head around this.
Yeah.
It seems like quite a leap. The more you reflect on really what's deeply in this text, how big of a jump they're asking us to make from where the evolutionary mainstream was in the early 20th century. But clearly, it's indicated. They're like, this is where we expect you to rise to. This is where your planet will need to be in 1,000 years or whatever that is. Like, these are the stakes. You're ready for this on some level.
Yeah, but the blueprint's not the source, too. So engineering sort of the design itself doesn't account for the essence or the source of these higher aspects of deity that are engaging on layer upon layer of engagement.
Right.
So,
yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, it's all, yeah, you have to think in very, you know, systematic terms as a way of expressing what you're getting at there. But it isn't, yeah, it isn't as it might appear on first, you know, read. Well, it's just completely hands. It's just a bunch of creatures, and like, no, no. This distinction is vital, right? For the cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. I mean, all the parts, like life carrier parts, are part of the cosmic system.
Yes.
And so, you know, the whole is supreme, pardon the pun. so, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. These three orders stand on an equal footing in the ascension career, Each must traverse the same intellectual scale of development, and each must master the same spiritual tests of progression. The system administration and the constellation over control of these different worlds are uniformly free from discrimination. Even the regimes of the planetary princes are identical.
But there is, you know, fact for potential discrimination. Yeah, there are literally superior and inferior differences. And that's what's between the lines when they're saying that. It's not that that there is no reality to superior and inferior, like some materially idealistic people today want to think. The vertical difference is literally there, right? And so for those who manage that, it's up to them to choose to not discriminate in the negative sense of discriminate. Right? But
in
they
the
must
negative
discriminate
sense, right?
In the positive sense of discriminate. Right? They can't just go to the world, it doesn't matter if these are one brain or two brain or three brain. Okay, no, I mean, you have to face facts. You have to meet, as a descending sun, you have to meet the creatures as you find them.
But the beauty is that sentence, each must traverse the same intellectual scale of development and each must master the same spiritual tests of progression. You see that twofold pattern of the consecration of mind to the mother and the consecration of will to the father. It applies to the wholeness, regardless of one, two, or three brained.
Yeah, not to mention, getting back to Brad's review, right, of, where you're thinking that it all just, you've got to get the Paradise Free card. No, you have to pass tests.
Yes.
And not everyone passes those tests, like you might think from your high school days.
Right.
Chris,
everyone gets a trophy.
Will their Marantia mind be different as well? I mean, I'm sure it will, but it's not. There's not like one brain, two brain, three brain Marantia mind.
No, but like we pointed out, all these things feed into the initial nature of the souls that are resurrected.
Okay, that makes sense.
Even if it's literally, morphologically parallel. Right? But, a three-brainer is likely to have less issues to deal with, perhaps, on the first and second mansion worlds than a one-brainer. Maybe not, right? I mean, three-brainers can screw themselves up too, right? But
maybe they can really screw themselves up. Maybe they're really
Again, right? Right. More has been given to them, so more is required of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It might be easier for a one-brainer to get to the first mansion world because he has a great big asterisk next to his name, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. This guy has lots of valid excuses. Don't be too hard on him. Or you're a three-brainer and you're thinking you're hot stuff. Like, well. I can see some issues here. You should have, and you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's it's not unlike we have the fifth epical revelation. So your asterisk is smaller now. You have less valid excuses.
More light. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Justin, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure. Thanks, Brad. Number 3, Spirit Reception Series. There are 3 groups of mind design as related to contact with spirit affairs. This classification does not refer to the 1, 2, and 3-brained orders of mortals. It refers primarily to gland chemistry, more particularly to the organization of certain glands comparable to the pituitary bodies. The races on some worlds have 1 gland, on others 2, as do Urantians, while on still other spheres, the races have 3 of these unique bodies. the inherent imagination and spiritual receptivity is definitely influenced by this differential chemical endowment.
Okay. So how is this different from, you know, this kind of vertical story we were, you know, fleshing out with the brain types? Okay. I mean, you know, recognizing that with, you know, that we were thinking of sort of starting it at three different levels, right, in your attempt to go upward. The lowest level for the one-brainers, you know, and the highest level for the three-brainers. But, you know, you can kind of just, you know, if you visualize that sort of vertical spectrum, okay, but there still is the issue of the interface between the top and what's above, the cosmos.
Yeah.
That's what this is about. So even if you're a three-brainer, right, and you have the potential to kind of be, you know, using more immediately higher mind activity, what if, you know, the interface, the membrane, if you will, between, you know, your mindful self and the cosmos is not very permeable. You know, there's a broadcast coming down, but you have poor receptivity because you have only one of these glands. Right, so you could have three-brainers with three glands, and they would, you know, have it all, or you could be a three-brainer with only one gland, and it's like you're up there, but you can't really reciprocate the cosmos down into your mind very well because of how opaque that interface is. So that's what this is about, the issue of how, you know, what is it, you know, the interplay across that boundary like? You know, is it pretty sluggish or is it very fluid?
Of the spirit reception types, 65% are of the second group, like the Urantia races. 12% are of the first type, naturally less receptive, while 23% are more spiritually inclined during terrestrial life. But such distinctions do not survive natural death. All of these racial differences pertain only to the life in the flesh.
Okay, so now again, another aspect is to make sure this is clear. Notice that it's called spirit reception series. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking, when you're using the word spiritual here, in contrast to using it about the brain types, okay, you know, you're more directly thinking about the spirit energy, you know, and, you know, ability to interface with your mind. Whereas when you're talking spiritual, in that brain type hierarchy, right? It's more directly, you know, how much ability for personality management do you have? If you're one brainer, you don't have as much natural ability for personality management. If you're a three brainer, you have much more innate ability for personality management. But, what about the issue of how much sort of reflective assistance from the nature of the cosmos do you get in that personality management? Are you, can you kind of tune in on the cosmic broadcast, as it were, you know, better or worse? You know, so that you have more of a reference for, oh, I should manage it like this, as opposed to, well, I don't really get much information on how to manage it. Boy, I seem to be able to really manage my mind, but, you know, I don't really know what the standard is. See, that would be a three-brainer with one gland.
And when you put it that way, I know this has been the theme of the evening almost, but, you know, you an immature reader of this, or me, could chafe a little bit. It's like, I want three brains and I want three glands. Like, there's a part of you that wants to be in Havana as soon as possible.
And when do you want them now?
No being in the universe has ever had any issues with patience. You know, that's never caused a default. Eve, that's never caused a rebellion. Lucifer. Yeah, we need to, you know, we need to challenge that impatience and, you know, and that desire for self-aggrandizement. That doesn't sound like humble to me. You know, and pride goeth before the fall. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. So, you know, they, you know, we're left to speculate. You know, you could. It's like, you know, they already kind of gave you a clue comparable to the pituitary bodies, right? So it's like, well, okay, so you know, at least part of, you know, of that pituitary gland, you know, maybe more immediately what they're thinking of, you know, maybe the anterior part, say. That's why there's a plural bodies there, right? And if anyone knows about the complexity of the structure there. You know, it's like, well, is the other kind of a la Descartes? Is it everyone's favorite third eye? You know, is it the pineal gland? You know, again, talk about pop psychology, and it goes all the way back to Descartes.
It does.
You know, but, you know, it seems like a reasonable first guess. You know, and so, you know, you can read scientific, you know, summaries about what the pituitary gland and the pineal gland, you know, are all about materially, but they're telling you here, no, the most important thing about them is your spirit reception and how that's modified by your gland chemistry. The, you know, the ability of the spirit of truth to influence your mind, the ability of the thought adjuster to influence your mind is, you know, modified, limited by gland chemistry.
Yeah. You know, regarding,
I mean, if
your...
nothing else, it's at least another reminder that maybe I shouldn't do stark chemical things to my body that might mess up my chemistry.
I was just thinking, I mean, you know, there's almost, I guess it's an, yeah, at one point I heard someone being referred disparagingly to someone as a pituitary case. I think it was, I don't even remember what the context was, but clearly they were implying something was very off. Yeah, so don't let your glands be very off.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, it's like, oh, I'm pretty sure this drug makes me have so much closer relationship to my thought adjuster. No, it probably completely prevents you from having any relation because you've got some sort of transmaterial delicate thing here about how mother deity can relate spirit to mind energy. You know, and you just do some slight little tweak of the gland chemistry and it all stops.
I was watching this show one time about what alcohol does to your body, and one of the things he mentioned is that it impacts the pineal gland.
There's just all, yeah, I mean, you know, there's, you know, obvious, you know, many, you know, drugs influence you either obviously vertically, like we've talked about, or take you very far afield horizontally so that you're way off center where the neck of the hourglass is. Yeah, and so it's just very obvious, right, that these sorts of molecular manipulations are not very wise if you'd like to be an ascender.
4, planetary mortal epochs. This classification recognizes the succession of temporal dispensations as they affect man's terrestrial status and his reception of celestial ministry.
Okay, the simple thing here is just to notice, unlike the simplification of the paper title, Planetary Mortal Epochs, right, which, you know, follows this one, right, it's paper 52. Notice the hyphen here. Okay?
Yeah.
Where they're, you know, where they're reminding you that if it wasn't kind of, you know, purposely simplified, you know, paper title, you know, I mean, it isn't... you know, mortal epochs, you know, with a planetary scale. No, it's epochs of planetary mortals. When we went through paper 52 a while back on Symmetry of Soul here. I mean, you know, just like we're talking about different brain types, different spirit reception types, I mean, there are different types of human in each dispensation.
Yes.
Different types of planetary mortals in different epochs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a different planetary mortal, right, that's, you know, being launched, you know, epically, right, at the beginning of each dispensation. Yeah, so you see it very, you know, definitively here. You know, man's terrestrial status and his reception of celestial ministry. Right? So all, you know, yet another way where I'd like to be, you know, very, you know, receptive of the cosmos so that I can be conformal to it. But I'm a very lowly mortal relative to the planetary mortal ethics. And so there's only so much I can do. I'm not a mortal in the era of light and life. There's a, you know, much more receptive, has a much higher status.
Another reason to chafe impatiently at the cosmos, if you're really sure that God put you in the wrong place and time to be born. Why me, Lord? Why now? You know, the cry of many.
Oh, no, the sun is about to rise again. Let's all howl.
Right.
We always joke here. Right? Yet another day of oppression. But you know, again, see, just, you know, this is an obvious thing that's going through here, right? A challenge to be humble and a challenge to conceive of a more real God, right? You know, and a relationship to that more real God that's transcendent of all these things. The God you seek is, you know, the real God is somewhere way above all these seed of clay issues that we have. You know, more than we ever imagined we had. Right? I mean, it's like, you know, we're just an endless litany here, right? Oh, and your clay feet are now bigger, and they're even bigger. Oh, and they're still bigger yet. Right. It begins to seem hopeless. I could never ascend, right, with these 500,000 pound shoes on.
Life is initiated on the planets by the life carriers, who watch over its development until some time after the evolutionary appearance of mortal man. Before the life carriers leave a planet, they duly install a planetary prince as ruler of the realm. With this ruler, there arrives a full quota of subordinate auxiliaries and ministering helpers, and the first adjudication of the living and the dead is simultaneous with his arrival.
It's always interesting to think about, you know, that it might not be very long, like they point out, you know, from the first will creatures until planetary prince arrives on a normal world. So, you know, how many are in that first dispensational resurrection? You know, it seems like it's probably a pretty small class, right? You know, that's graduated there.
But they have to get moving on because they're a different type of planetary mortal. The spiritual economy has to keep moving.
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, it seems like we try to point out, it's, you know, not only are they kind of, you know, essentially boat anchors now to progress down here, and you need to get them off the planet. But you know, I mean, it's primarily, they're all of the same type, and they need to be resurrected because there's a physics of resurrection. They need to be resurrected together. You can't mix, you know, the mortal types.
Whatever the physics of resurrection is
in those resurrection halls.
Plus the classes that they have set up for people after they resurrect, probably very specific for these different types of mortals.
Yeah.
Well, just so we don't miss it, can we talk about briefly the adjudication of the living? Am I missing something here?
The living and the dead. Yeah, I mean, that's it's clear once you notice the hyphen on planetary mortal that you literally are talking about a particular type of mortal. When the prince arrives, I mean, some of those, you know, mortal cells that were conceived before the prince arrived haven't died yet.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so, you know, you don't have a dispensational resurrection until everyone that was conceived before the dispensational boundary, you know, has died, you know, and can be transported, their soul can be transported up there. So it's always the living and the dead, right? Because of those that are close to the boundary line.
Huh. Yeah.
Right. I mean, just think about all the people that you're reading about, and when you're reading about Jesus' life, okay, see, they're of the prior dispensation, right? So there was no dispensational resurrection until all of them had died.
I guess I hadn't really gotten down to the brass tacks of it, but it would have to be like that, even though the, you know, the trumpet sounded at, you know, on a particular day. It may have been, you know, whatever, 50 or 100 more years. Well, no, it's John Zebedee was probably one of the last. Yeah.
Exactly.
Whenever that was.
Yeah. That's what I was going to bring up.
103 years or something like that.
Right.
Okay, wait. Yeah. So you're saying that when John Zebedee died, that's when the actual resurrection?
Just, you know,
well,
think
no,
about,
I mean, whoever the,
think about
whoever
some child that
was
conceived, you know, 5 minutes before the new dispensation was established.
Right, right.
Okay, so yeah, whoever the last guy.
Maybe they lived to a ripe old age.
Right. I just used John Zebedee as a cutoff point, but you're saying it doesn't happen. That's
John Zebedee is part of the prior dispensation.
Sure.
He's one
so
of the living.
So just for the sake of getting this straight, let's say it was John Zebedee. I'm sure it wasn't, but let's just say. So when he died, that's when when the resurrection happened, the adjudication.
Well, you've got to transport all these souls, right, to the first mansion world. That's a 5-year trip, right? You got to assemble it all together, and then you have a dispensational resurrection. I mean, everyone's got to have Maharaja bodies built for them and all this stuff.
So the answer to that is yes, that it does happen when the last...
Yeah, eventually
because, I thought it was in conjunction with the pouring out of the Spirit of Truth.
Well, see, you have an adjudication of the living and the dead, right? See, at that moment.
Okay.
Right. But the actual resurrection, right? You know, remember, you know, you can clear this up by just remembering that adjudication is something in between death and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we're just facing the literalness of that, okay? There's an adjudication, right, that's, you know, while they're still living.
Interesting, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there has to be some, you know, I mean, you know, initially you're just saying, okay, so all these are part of this dispensation, you know, that there's that initial sort of just putting them in that bin of adjudication. I mean, obviously, there's not going to be a final decision until after they die. But again, just recognizing is just, you know, it's just reminding you that they're part of the prior dispensation, some of those people that are alive, right, at the dispensational boundary.
Okay.
All those people that are alive, I should say, not some of those, all those people that are alive at the time of the boundary, you know, are part of the prior one.
With
so
the
adjudication.
Go ahead.
Well, the adjudication happened simultaneous with his arrival, but the actual resurrection and carting these people off, that doesn't happen until later.
Yeah, I mean, you got to transport them there, and then you got to build bodies for them, and then you have to actually resurrect them.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Yep.
With the emergence of human groupings, this planetary prince arrives to inaugurate human civilization and to focalize human society. Your world of confusion is no criterion of the early days of the reign of the planetary princes, for it was near the beginning of such an administration on Urantia that your planetary prince, Caligastia, cast his lot with the rebellion of the system sovereign Lucifer. Your planet has pursued a stormy course ever since.
No criterion.
Boy, really?
It's much worse now than it was 200,000 years ago, is what they're telling you there.
Wow.
Okay. In the relevant issues here. And again, you see it very literally that, you know, the prince and his staff on every world come as civilizational uplifters, like we've talked about. And, to inaugurate human civilization and to focalize it. You know, it's diffuse, and you need to take, you know, if there is any budding concepts of family, you know, it's at best mother family, you got to focalize that to father family. You know, if there's some sort of trans-tribal thoughts bubbling up, you need to focalize that into definitive, you know, national life, etc. That's what they're getting at with the focalize there.
Hmm. Andrea, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure. On a normal evolutionary world, racial progress attains its natural biologic peak during the regime of the planetary prince, and shortly thereafter, the system sovereign dispatches a material son and daughter to that planet. These imported beings are of service as biologic uplifters. Their default on Urantia further complicated your planetary history.
Now, remember, this is all being said, you know, prior to the Planetary Mortal Ethics paper. You know, that's why you get a little bit of, description here, thumbnail sketches. You know, we all kind of have talked about this a lot, but again, just keep in mind, you know, that there's something going on much more profound than just what you see on the surface. Oh, their children are going to mate with mortals, and they're going to be biologic uplifters, and they're going to teach them science and all this. Yeah, but literally, right, those descending sons inaugurated a new type of mortal in that world. That's the point of reading these in this section. Right? It's not the external, you know, doings, you know, like the teachings of the prince and his staff, okay, but the literal fact that they're teaching, you know, mortals that are different. Right? Pre-planetary prince dispensation mortals are primitive mortals. Then they're changed, so they're not primitive anymore. Because the whole spiritual energy phenomenon, and hence the mindal phenomenon, is different. The environment changed, if you will, and hence the beings that are subject to that environment in ways we can't even imagine we are, changed.
Yeah.
I mean, their genetics is still the same, right? But what's happening upon that foundation is different.
Right. When the intellectual and ethical progress of a human race has reached the limits of evolutionary development, there comes an avonal son of paradise on a magisterial mission, and later on, when the spiritual status of such a world is nearing its limit of natural attainment, the planet is visited by a paradise bestowal sun. The chief mission of a bestowal sun is to establish the planetary status, release the spirit of truth for planetary function, and thus effect the universal coming of the thought adjusters. Yeah, look how far out in the future this is for most normal worlds, and we've already got that.
Yeah, but it's sad to record that most people don't take delight in cultivating, so it's as if it's not there at all.
It's more like gasoline on a fire.
if it does impact, it causes problems, right, like we've talked about. But, you know, just think of it in just a neutral sense. We've been reading about all these ways that we're inferior. Okay, and so we're way down below, you know, any sort of immediate interface with all these things that are poured out, on the top of us, right? I mean, if you don't get up to interacting with that interface at the top, It's as if they're not there. And just one little technical thing. Notice that interesting way, establish the planetary status and then they explain it, release the spirit of truth for planetary function. Okay, I mean, you've got the spirit of truth, ubiquitous, throughout the local universe, you know, subsequent to the first time, a world gets that. It's not just, you know, one cable running from Salvington to that world. It's, you know, it's poured out on the ubiquitous spirit substrate of the Creative Mother Spirit of that local universe.
Yes. Right?
But the issue is, has it been focalized down onto a particular planet? No, and that doesn't happen until subsequent to the bestowal sun.
Here again, Urantia deviates. There has never been a magisterial mission on your world. Neither was your bestowal sun of the Avanal Order. Your planet enjoyed the signal honor of becoming the mortal home planet of the sovereign sun, Michael of Nebadon.
But, right, of him to whom much is given, much is required. Right? Right, if we have that signal honor, right, so again, we have an even greater challenge that we face. And we have to overcome the rebellion and the default, and we have to rise to the challenge of, of having that bestowal sun.
Right. Without a magisterial sun to kind of pave the way. We had a Melchizedek maybe doing a little bit of that work, but it was emergency and very nominal and barely much at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was, trying to just make sure that there was some spiritual predicate. He wasn't there as an intellectual uplifter.
No.
Yeah. And so, again, we're talking about all these ways that our intellect is, inferior, down too low. We didn't get it uplifted, either biologically or through nature or through nurture, the nurture of a magisterial son, and not the nature of an Adam and Eve. So again, just notice how it's constantly reminding us that it's time to be about the Father's business. I mean, to assume that you have a free pass and you really don't have to do anything is, after you read this, is, should be even, more absurd to you than it was when Brad was pointing out how absurd it was in the summary.
Very true, Chris.
As a result of the ministry of all the successive orders of divine sonship, the inhabited worlds and their advancing races begin to approach the apex of planetary evolution. Such worlds now become ripe for the culminating mission, the arrival of the Trinity Teacher Sons. This epoch of the Teacher Sons is the vestibule to the final planetary age, evolutionary utopia, the age of light and life.
We don't really need to dwell on that too much right here. I mean, again, like I pointed out, this is all giving us a thumbnail in advance of paper 52, right? Just so that in this context, you have an appreciation of how many different types of planetary mortals there are. And if you haven't read paper 52 yet.
This classification of human beings will receive particular attention in a succeeding paper.
As I've said multiple times, yeah.
Yeah.
Number 5, creature kinship serials. Planets are not only organized vertically into systems, constellations, and so on, but the universe administration also provides for horizontal groupings according to type, series, and other relationships. This lateral administration of the universe pertains more particularly to the coordination of activities of a kindred nature which have been independently fostered on different spheres. These related classes of universe creatures are periodically inspected by certain composite core of high personality presided over by long experienced finaliters.
Okay, so here's, you know, we see them using serial, and you can kind of understand why they would be using words with that AL suffix, you know, the series like. Okay, type, series, and other relationships. So, quote unquote, series like, right? And the point is that, remember when we began this, you know, enumerated list here at the beginning of Section 5, they said, you know, if you go through these seven, they say mortal creatures may be studied from numerous viewpoints, among which are the following. Okay. Well, it's one thing to, you know, just abstract, you know, abstractly study, you know, well, here's all of the worlds with three-brainers, you know, and let's kind of just, you know, consider them and what patterns do we see across that whole series of three-brained worlds. Okay, it's one, you know, thing to just study. But see, they're bringing in, you know, there's an administrative identification to these. You know,
yeah.
So there's a nurture difference because it isn't just an abstraction. You know, and so, you know, all of the three-brainers have a series to them because of this, you know, separateness of administrative engagement. Right, we saw that with the decimal worlds. Right? They already mentioned this creature kinship thing when they're talking about the decimal worlds in item number one. Right, so that's what they're getting at here. Yet another way, right? That this isn't just an abstraction, but becomes a literal, a nurture difference, and hence a creature difference.
Huh? Interesting. Yeah. Thanks for working through that.
Kinship factors are manifest on all levels, for kinship serials exist among non-human personalities as well as among mortal creatures, even between human and superhuman orders. Intelligent beings are vertically related in 12 great groups of 7 major divisions each. The coordination of these uniquely related groups of living beings is probably affected by some not fully comprehended technique of the Supreme Being.
Okay, so, you know, like in paper 36, you know, section 2, that we pointed to before, okay, you know, they're pointing out, you know, you have, if you just take the plane of mortals in the flesh, you have this diversity, like they talk about there, with 12-fold and 7-fold and 3-fold. Okay. But here they're pointing out that, you know, that isn't just with mortals, but, you know, seraphim and, you know, all the other kinds of beings. I mean, these 3, 7, 12 patterns are all, and that all gets somehow coordinated in the context of, you know, the Universal Mother's influence from the Supreme Being.
Hmm.
Okay. And I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. You know, we don't have the time to flesh it out, but I just wanted to read you one little sentence I wrote in the Pattern Universe paper that I often tease about, you know, where I unpack some of these issues, like the 12-fold pattern. And, you know, just playing off of a statement there in paper 36, section 2, I say the domain of life is characterized by the numbers 3, 7, and 12. Because life animation is drawn from the foundational unity of the infinite and then patterned by the imposition of the threefold individuation of deity unity, the sevenfold individuation of spirit unity, and the 12-fold individuation of mind unity. Okay?
Whoa.
And that's not just down at the, you know, corporeal level. Right? You have that, you know, that statement that they make there, you know, about, you know, the domains of life, having these, this numerology, if you will, a logic, you know, with precise numbers associated with it. Anyway, it comes from that. And so, you know, and all of that, when all is said and done, it has some, you know, inscrutable coordination, you know, in the presence of the Supreme.
Wonderful.
You know, one other thing that this number five creature of kinship serials brings to mind for me, two things. One, it reminds me of the associativity of an ascender arriving on Havona and experientially engaging with the Havona native, and then this new potential of a father fragment being able to reside in that Havona native as a result of that associativity. And then it also makes me think of, at a higher level, the process of the adventure of trinitization, just the associativity at that really, really, really high level. So there's something even down here in the time and space domain where this kinship, this associativity, plays a really crucial role in adding a super additive consequence to something new.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we're talking about just, you know, so much more than two things in a differential. So, yeah, that's why you actually will use sometimes the word supersummative. Just look at all of this complexity, all of these differentiations.
Yes.
That you can think of horizontally, vertically, and every which way. And all of the supersummative consequences of all that is what goes into finalizing the grand universe.
It's so beautiful. Oh. It's so beautiful.
Number six, adjuster fusion series. The spiritual classification or grouping of all mortals during their pre-fusion experience is wholly determined by the relation of the personality status to the indwelling mystery monitor. Almost 90% of the inhabited worlds of Nebadon are peopled with adjuster fusion mortals, in contrast with a nearby universe where scarcely more than one half of the world harbor beings who are adjuster indwelt candidates for eternal fusion.
Yeah, so, you know, if you ever try, where is it that it says that? It's right here. It's secreted in this paragraph here, right, about that nearby universe where it's just over 50, you know, it's only just over 50%, you know, that are product users, you know. Almost 50% are spirit fusers in that local universe. You know, and remember, you have basically this, you know, you either have a spirit fuser or you have a father fuser, but there might be that little exception. They, you know, they've been long time, they've been a zeroth circler, you know, they're post-first circler, right? But that final synchronization, that quote-unquote zeroth circler process just doesn't happen and doesn't happen. They get all the way to Salvington in our case. And still nothing, right? And that's when you know, it's recognized that they're an exception to, you know, being merely a product user, and you know, they first become sun-fused.
Sun-fused, yeah.
Right, but it's, but again, just, you know, not just thinking about the fusion process, but the fact that, you know, you have a literal difference, right? You know, a series here as you can study, right? Because it's a different series of mortals that are spirit fusers than those who are father fusers.
Number seven, techniques of terrestrial escape. There is fundamentally only one way in which individual human life can be initiated on the inhabited world, and that is through creature procreation and natural birth. But there are numerous techniques whereby man escapes his terrestrial status and gains access to the inward moving stream of paradise ascenders.
Oh,
besides,
tell us more.
Death,
tune in next week.
Besides, okay.
Yeah. Go on, yeah.
All right, so that's what we'll flesh out, you know, next week is section 6 expounds on that. You don't have to go all the way to paper 52, right, like with the planetary mortal epics.
Okay, good.
But again, see, thinking of it, you know, is not just a, you know, a process issue, but, you know, a literal, you know, different creature type issue, and the series of that, and how that fits into, you know, coordination of the supreme and all these complex things. That's what they're wanting you to, you know, to come away with here.
All right,
very
folks.
Interesting.
Well, that's where we'll leave it. We hope that you come back here next Tuesday. A fascinating subject, and next Tuesday we'll round out this long arc we've been on. In the meantime, pray intelligently according to light. Good night.
Take care, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Yes. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next week. We'll contemplate our escape from our mortal fetters. And I hope everyone has a wonderful week. Take care. Peace be upon you.